why had I switched from physical geography to humanistic geography? I replied that I had always wanted to do humanistic geography, but that I was temporarily derailed by the beauty of the desert landscape. I fell in love with emptiness and harshness, with death, or rather a mineral world in which there was neither eating nor being eaten, neither decay nor cessation of breath. That became a common state of mind for me in adulthood. A premonition of it occurred, however, much earlier, when I was a child of 12 or 13. In a dream, I realized with preternatural clarity that being alive could mean only one thing, that one day I would die. Grown-ups sought to deflect my anxiety by saying that I would outgrow it. Most children did, as their curiosity turned from metaphysics to the opposite sex and to such solid school subjects as physics and chemistry. Mine didn't. I continued to be haunted by what I deemed to be fundamental questions.
Yifu Tuan is widely considered the founder of humanistic geography, a study of geographical phenomena as a way to gain insight into the human condition and potential. It involves not only the way people interact with nature, but also their feelings and ideas in regard to space and place. What can humanistic geography tell us about today's dramatic changes in the way land is being used? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
What can a humanistic approach tell us about geographical knowledge of territory and place, crowding and privacy, livelihood and economics, and religion? And what can it do that a quantitative approach to geography can't do? And when Yifu Tuan returned to China more than 60 years after he left it for the West, how did humanistic geography account for the vast changes that he found there? Yifu Tuan is Professor Emeritus of Geography at the UW-Madison and is the author of several books, including Space and Place, The Perspective of Experience, Cosmos and Hearth, A Cosmopolite's Viewpoint, and most recently, Coming Home to China, published in 2007 by the University of Minnesota Press.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
I was struck by your most recent book, the Coming Home to China book, by the way that you weave together the sense of space with your own personal identity and background. You write in your reflections section near the end, "Where do I belong? Am I a Chinese, an American Chinese, a Chinese American, or an American?" And I wondered if you would start by just talking about your own identity, where you were born in China, when you came here, and how that has shaped the work you do now.
I was born in China in 1930, and I left it at age 10 for Australia in 1941, and had not really been back to China until 2005. So that's 64 years later. And I hesitated to go back for various reasons, one of which was that the longer I hold back my return, the older I get, the more difficult the long trip. So by the time I'm in my 70s, I didn't like the idea of, 11, 12 hours of flying. And also, China, for all its huge economic development, is still third world in some ways. In one way in particular, and that is its toilets.
It's plumbing,
not
yes.
up to date.
It's notorious that way, although
right.
I guess Kohler is doing a lot to update it.
Yes, it's amazing. You go to a fancy restaurant with chandeliers and moderns, and then you go to the restroom and you enter the third world. So that made me very nervous. But there's also a psychological reason, which is more important, which made me hold back. And that was my realization that when I go back to China as a man of 75 years old and supposedly a scholar, and yet I wouldn't know how to behave as a well-educated elderly Chinese. I mean, I've lost the elementary skills of social exchange. You know, I may do the wrong thing or say the wrong thing quite unintentionally. One example that really made me hesitate was that in 1988, I went to Taiwan because my stepmother was there and I was asked to speak at some universities. And when I went to Taipei, my stepmother opened a closet and it was full of packed gifts that she had prepared for me. And she then told me that this gift is for that person and so on. And I thought China being, you know, part of the same civilization, that there would also be this gift exchange as one of the ways that you know how to behave. And I had no idea what gifts to give to whom. So I really hesitated. And there's also the question of language. I left at age 10. My two brothers have also left at an early age, but they were married to Chinese women, so they spoke Chinese at home. So mm-hmm. they were more practiced in our native language than I am, because I'm single and I'm surrounded by English-American speaking people. And I feel that I would certainly be asked to speak in China, and I would be embarrassed having to speak it in English. Here I am, supposedly, obviously, a Chinese scholar. And lastly, actually, as a consequence of what I've just said, I have to confront my identity. Not just what am I, who am I? An American Chinese, a Chinese American, an American, a Chinese. So yeah. Let me give you an example of how I avoided the issue. That is, quite a few years ago, there was a football match between Iranian team that was visiting and Americans, I think, in Los Angeles. And the stadium was packed with people, most of whom were Iranian Americans, and many of whom were born in America. So they were born in Oregon, in California, Washington, places like that. But it's reported that overwhelmingly these Americans, these Iranian Americans, cheered or rooted for the Iranian team rather than the American one. So that led me to ask myself the question. And I didn't want to answer. So on the occasions when I turned on the television and watched Olympic Games and there was a competition between a Chinese athlete and an American athlete, I turned it off. Mm-hmm. I don't really want to know where my gut feelings are in this. So I had to face all these things. And I wasn't quite sure I wanted to.
Now, the field that you've become famous for sort of, I suppose, defining and working in, the humanistic geography, tell us what that is. I mean, first of all, start with geography itself, but then give us some sort of sense of what humanistic geography is.
I can tell this perhaps in an autobiographical way. I've just read a piece in which I express my anxiety about the meaning of life when I reached 13 or puberty. And one way of answering questions of this kind, the meaning of life, would be to go into philosophy or religion as a subject of study. I did consider that, but in the end, I decided not to, particularly not philosophy, because I tried to read some philosophy works and found them so abstract and so skeptical of knowledge, so that I said to myself, if I studied philosophy on my deathbed, I might have to confess that I don't know anything. I don't even know whether this table exists. So I need something firmer. And And that still addresses my big question. But I don't want to start at the top, at the philosophical, metaphysical level. I want to start from the ground up. And so before I raise these big questions, obviously there is a prior question, namely, how do humans make a living in different parts of the world? And that to me is down to earth, and it also is geography, human geography. It has always been human geography. But the problem with traditional human geography is that this question of livelihood for people stops at economic livelihood or at social questions. It never, almost never rises above that to the questions that I'm interested in. So I said then, oh, right, I'll start with my feet firmly on the ground. That is, with human geography. Human geography studies different livelihoods in different parts of the world. But I'm not going to stop at the economic. I'm going to raise some other questions which eventually lead to the good life. What is the good life? And that leads to, of course, the meaning of life.
Do you have the sense, though, that many of those people who are engaging in this livelihood never get to that higher level because they're so consumed by just the necessities?
Right. This is something that I don't perhaps see completely eye to eye with my colleagues, not only in geography, but in the social sciences. That is the habit they have of using the word survival, that the way they describe livelihood, it's a struggle to survive. And that word, survive and survival, perhaps because of its biological basis in evolution, survival, has caught on to the degree that people would, upper middle class professional people would send their children to the wilderness to have a great time and call that survival technique.
Yes.
So it's all survival. You get the feeling that humans everywhere are just hanging on, barely surviving. Well, that certainly is true of many people, but I hardly think that this is true of the human condition generally, that even in what we would consider poverty-stricken peasant societies, you know, they want to think that they are more than hanging on. Indeed, they are. At the minimum, they have festivities, festivals, certainly religious thinking about a better life, a good life. And surely they would occasionally just enjoy life, sitting under the tree to chat and things like that. So I start modestly, going beyond the economic and the social, to a people's notion, their own notion of what good life may be, what they are hoping for, even though they can't arrive at it.
Well, if you apply your tools as a human geographer to Wisconsin, for example, before we get back to China, if you just look around Wisconsin through the eyes that you've developed as a human geographer, what is it that you see or write about or notice?
No doubt a great part of the world would look at Wisconsin and think that this is it. This is the good life. And certainly the life I lead here is the good life. In all senses, for someone like me, because it's not only the economic, the social, but also I have the luxury of developing my mind. But on the other hand, I walk up and down State Street every day since my office is in Science Hall and I live in Doty School at the other side of the Isthmus. So I walk by State Street every day and I would be stopped two or three times in this short walk by panhandlers and homeless people. And I also regularly have coffee at the Starbucks and Steepen Brew. And there it's clear that there are some people who have nowhere to go. and who are just passing time there because it's pleasant. And the people there are generally nice. If you don't make a noise, they let you stay, even though you're not ordering anything. What you do is to trying to make time pass by picking up the newspapers that others had abandoned. So this is not, to me, the good life. So even in Wisconsin, even in Madison, there are certainly people who are not there.
How would you contrast those panhandlers with the ones that you encountered, or maybe even the ones you remember in China?
That's interesting, because now I have to correct myself a little bit. And that is, I said I left China at age 10 and did not return till 2005. It is not strictly true, because in 1946, my family was on its way from the Philippines to England. But we stopped for 2 weeks in Shanghai for a change of airplane and so on. And so I did stop for a short period in Shanghai in 1946. And I was 15 years old, and I was just shocked by the total breakdown of society and the economy in Shanghai in 1946. And we were being entertained by friends, and they would go to the restaurant carrying a suitcase, the suitcase being packed with paper money, which is becoming quite worthless, so the inflation is incredible. And to get into the restaurant, we would be stepping over the bodies of beggars, and they would be exhibiting their wounds, and it was just horrible. And since we had been living in Australia for 5 years, the land of milk and honey in that period, this was just shocking. So we said, you know, we couldn't step over these beggars to go into a fancy restaurant. But then we were told by our hosts that, no, these are not beggars. They are actors. They just want your money. So we didn't know whom to believe. But it's clear there's a tremendous amount of poverty, people who are desperate in China that was about to collapse and the communists about to take over. So this time, when I went back to China and stayed in the capital, Beijing, for 5 days and walked about, I didn't encounter a single panhandler, much less the beggar of the old days. So I thought, this is really peculiar. Until my last day in Shanghai before returning to the United States, we were walking along this fabulous walk along the Huangpu River. It's called the Bund. And I encountered my first beggar. And he was a man without legs. And then it again occurred to me that that's also an interesting contrast between a wealthy country like USA, Wisconsin, and a China which is not there yet. And that is to compare on the basis of my very limited sample of the panhandler in USA on State Street. Some of them look pretty healthy to me. And this guy, who was clearly desperate, no legs and starving. And so that's when they reduced to begging. That's the state, not someone as you find them here.
We want to hear more about what you found when you returned to China, because that's not only travel in space, but travel in time to go back after so many years away. More in a moment with University of the Year.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Campaign for Wisconsin Libraries, connecting you to a world of information, recreation, education, and imagination. Information about making a difference in libraries online at wisconsinlibraries.org.
So, how did I feel when I re-entered Jinnan Cun and stood at the door of my old home? I felt simultaneously and contradictorily, both more unreal and more real. I was a ghost trying to relive the world of a child and an old man given a fresh burst of life by infusions of odors and tactile sensations from the past.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Yifu Tuan, and we're talking about humanistic geography and, in particular, the way people's relationship to their living space, their environment, might have changed over the course of years. Yifu Tuan, having returned to China for the first time in more than 60 years just recently, when you returned to China after those more than 60 years, were there any human contacts that you could reconnect with? Or was it strictly your relationship, renewing your relationship with the place?
The return to China out of 64 years meant that the relatives I had were all dispersed or dead. So it's not that kind of contact. And yet, in some ways, the most interesting and most unexpected experiences were with people rather than with place. Because place, after all, I am professionally a geographer, so even though I had not been back, I sort of kept up with the changes in China. I've seen pictures of the new China. So, and when I got there, it was pretty much what I'd read about in this country. But even here, maybe I should pause at this point, even here, even knowing the degree of change, it still just overwhelmed me. For instance, Beijing, the city where we stayed for 5 days, as late as 1950, Beijing was still a walled city, a wall within wall, and those walls were essentially a cosmic diagram. And the history of a walled city that is a cosmic diagram goes back for thousands of years. So even in 1950, it was still a cosmic diagram. And the city was packed with buildings which were essentially of either the palace or the courtyard type. So here I was back in Beijing, and not being there for 64 years. And when I stepped out of my 5-star hotel, there was this huge traffic, and I immediately feared disorientation. So guess what my first stop was before I took a walk with my Chinese colleague here? Starbucks, right across the street. And we didn't have to walk far before we encountered these skyscrapers. Some of them were not only modern, but might be called postmodern, because it's an architect fully exploring the nature of the possibilities of materials. So in other words, what I'm saying is some of these buildings you see, at least from the outside, is counterintuitive. An intuitive building would be one which has a broad base and rises to a top like a pyramid. But some of the buildings might look reversed. They look top-heavy. And there was a bank where the flank tips out. So I looked at it. I said, well, it's about to fall. Would I want to put money in it?
Yeah.
So it's not only modern skyscrapers. It's really ultra-modern buildings in this city, which in my time was still a cosmic diagram becoming so totally modern.
I'm fascinated by this concept of the cosmic diagram. Does that imply that the whole relationship between people in Beijing has changed, their relationship between the people in Beijing and, well, the cosmos? I mean, have they simply lost that thought, that connection about their place in the larger scheme of things?
Pretty much lost. And that's a very interesting development. Humans, you know, anywhere on Earth practically, have to work hard, struggle to survive. So the peasants, people who live close to the land, not only work hard, but make an appeal to what we think of as religion, that is, to spirits and deities living in the mountain, in the river, deities and spirits that you have to appease because they somehow govern the seasons, govern rainfall, and govern your life. Well, the next stage in human development, so to speak, not only in China but elsewhere, is when people started to think, on Earth, we have all these irregularities, irregular topography. True, we have the seasons, but they're not dependable. So everything is kind of chaotic. But if you look to the heaven, you can find order if you pick certain things.
And stability, relative right. stability.
Yes. And the sun always rises in the east and sets in the west. So wouldn't it be wonderful if we can bring this cosmic order to Earth? And that's what they did. And so the city of Beijing and others like that, which I call a cosmic diagram, was basically a huge, originally a huge ceremonial center. And the first things to be built were the walls. And the walls were oriented to the cardinal points. So first thing you need to determine is to have an astronomer who can align north and south. So that means identifying the North Star and so on. So you depend on astronomy. And then aligning the wall east-west to the sunrise, sunset, and so on. And at the center of it would be a ceremonial complex. It would be the emperor and the priests who together conduct rituals that ensure this heavenly order persists. And so, interestingly enough, something that people perhaps don't quite see or understand, that in the effort to bring geometric order to Earth, the builders had to erase the irregularities on Earth. So guess what? They bulldozed villages. They said, you can't have a village here because we want straight streets. And they leveled hills and changed the courses of streams. I say bulldozer. Of course, we didn't have bulldozer, but they were human mega machines.
So sure. That's why Beijing, except for, I guess, for the Summer Palace, is flat?
Yes.
Well, it was actually flattened by the people.
Yes. Well, the land was not hilly. This is North China. But even then, there are topographic irregularities. There are certainly pre-existent settlements, which they had to remove. And their trees had to be cleared to create a geometric diagram of rectangular walls and streets that were a rectangle to each other.
And you talk about the front and back of yes. buildings as well as having been planned. You know, I'm struck by the irony of your title, Coming Home to China, because if there are Starbucks, then sort of coming home to China is coming back to your place of birth, but also finding it as modern skyscrapers and Starbucks.
Very much so. That is really very interesting because I consider myself a humanistic geographer, but there is also a field that I find a great deal of sympathy for, and that's called cultural geography. Actually, there's not much difference. So culturally speaking, going from USA to more China today, there's hardly any shock. Starting with the airport, I got off the Beijing airport and entered the airport and said, oh, I could be in New York or Philadelphia or Paris. It's the same. Even the intercom messages, of course, are in Chinese, but it's the same message. And the airplane pilots attendants, they're all dressed in a Western-style uniform. The only difference is that they all speak Chinese. So if you look at the material culture, there's hardly shock at all. It's just pretty much the same. But when you look at the people, well, they're just like the people I'd see in Madison or Milwaukee or anywhere. From babies to old people, they're all dressed in Western style. And, of course, I had a lot to do with the universities there. and the students were even one step ahead. So they were just indistinguishable from American students, you know, practically wearing their golf caps backward. And, of course, cell phone, chatting away, and a backpack. And one school that I visited, because that was the school I went to 64 years ago, even got rid of a uniform and took the American style that everyone dressed, you know, whatever you like, provided it's not too outrageous. And so then I said, well, there are various levels of culture. One is the material culture on a large scale, like buildings. Well, I don't see much difference. If anything, Beijing seemed a little more modern than Chicago even. The second would be the level of dress and food. There, the dress seemed to have gone quite Western. And even food, well, I did go to Starbucks, it's the first thing, and Western food is very popular. So I said, okay, that's the second level. And there's a still deeper level, at least that's the way I think. And that is music, the songs, your favorite songs. So I asked the students, and they're just rock stars. Maybe some of them are Chinese rock stars, but they're certainly not singing Chinese songs. So I said that, you know, there's no shock. And then came the surprise. And that was a very pleasant surprise because there are certain traditions that I thought had been wiped out, first by the Cultural Revolution and second by capitalist money-making. And the two traditions being, well, they're closely related. One is respect for age, and the second is respect for the teacher. I was really surprised that these very old, timeless Confucian virtues had not totally disappeared.
You mean you felt that toward you when you were there, for example?
Very much so.
As a teacher coming in to speak and...
Right.
I'm curious about your language, because presumably everyone would have expected you to speak fluent Chinese. And I was just curious, too, in terms of going back, whether a lot of the language that you had thought would be lost came back or...
Yes, quite a bit did come back. If you start speaking it, it does come back. And I also have to say that I have no problem speaking Chinese at the social level. If we're having a dinner here, I can easily carry on a conversation in Chinese. And my accent, they tell me, is flawless. It's Beijing dialects, Mandarin, or what they're called. It's when I need to present more formally, then I run into difficulties, even with the simplest words. So one of my areas of specialty are captured by the words space and place. They're hardly technical terms. They're quite ordinary words. But even these two words are difficult to translate into Chinese. So when I need to give a lecture on my subject, I find that my Chinese is just not up to it. And my first embarrassment was at this architectural conference, which had Western foreigners and Chinese. And so the American and Australian speakers stood up and spoke in English and we simultaneously translated into Chinese. And then it would be Chinese scholars' turn, and obviously they speak Chinese. And I followed one of these Chinese scholars, and he introduced me in Chinese as a Chinese scholar. And so what a shock for the audience, some of them quite young, that this guy who is obviously Chinese starts to speak English like the Australians. But I did manage to cushion the shock by starting my lecture in Chinese by explaining why the rest of it is going to be English, basically telling them that I left as a child and was out of practice.
I'm intrigued by more of these things that you would have found after 64 years, differences in the way the space and the places were used, because, again, we've come from an imperial tradition or even the earlier Confucian tradition through communism and the Cultural Revolution, where it was all turned upside down in terms of pulling out every little blade of grass because lawns were considered Western. And then coming through and still into the capitalist expansion, what differences do you see in the way people actually thought about the places that they lived in? Were they no longer sacred places? Were they places that were being just exploited for immediate gain? Or what differences did you see?
When you look at the evidence, it's contradictory. In the first place, there is the strong and widely accepted notion that the Chinese are deeply rooted to their home, to their place. And part of that rootedness has to do with their ancestor worship, their respect for ancestors who were buried there, and the importance of the burial ground and maintaining it. All this imply a deeply rooted sense of place. And that's demonstrated by the reluctance of the Chinese to move away from the home place to seek greater, better economic opportunities elsewhere.
In the cities in particular, probably.
Right, or go to places that have more arable land, like moving out of the North China Plain to Manchuria or places where there's more land. They just didn't want to move. The grass is greener on the other side. Didn't seem to apply to the Chinese. So in this way, it's very different. And that difference is also illustrated in domestic setting, in the house. As I said, the traditional Chinese house is a courtyard house. And courtyard house looks inward. The rooms face inward to a courtyard, which may be beautifully landscaped. But when you approach the house, even though it belongs to a rich person, you might not be impressed because all you see is a blank wall. The beauty lies inside. But the beauty of the courtyard, the beauty allows certain contemplation, but it doesn't give you a view, what we think of as a view, and certainly not a panoramic view, because there's just not enough space. It's small. So the only unlimited space or view for the Chinese living in the courtyard house is vertical, the sky. So the Chinese homes may be separated by walls, but they're united by heaven, so to speak. They're all open mm-hmm. to the sky. And that is in vivid contrast with, let's say, a standard American home. And I had this experience when I was still new to the country and I wasn't quite sure what was proper behavior. And I was shocked when I was invited along with other Chinese students, American students, to go to a professor's home, which was located in the countryside. And when we got inside the door, I found the Americans all moving kind of across the living room and then stood at the picture window mm-hmm. admiring what's outside yeah. the house.
Right. Rather than where they were.
Right. Okay. I said, isn't this impolite? I mean, here you just walk right by the living room and say, oh, it's in a beautiful view. You know, but that's American.
That's interesting, that difference.
Right. So, and you're not looking upward to space, but outward, horizontally to space. And later I sort of understand this viewpoint, and I even tell students that Americans love this picture window which opens out to space. Americans love a good prospect, a good view. But prospect means not only a view, but prospect, your future. Mm-hmm. And that too is American.
Sure, the horizon, the frontier.
Right, yes.
We'll return in a moment with more thoughts about space and place and humanistic geography, both here and in China, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
PortalWisconsin.org includes a statewide events calendar, feature stories, news, virtual tours, streaming video and audio, a gallery of Wisconsin artists, course listings, and much more. It's all online at PortalWisconsin.org.
That nature must be controlled, and that in controlling it, damage might be done, did not seem to have distressed many Chinese then, nor does it do so now, much to the chagrin of Western environmentalists. Unlike Europeans and especially Americans, Chinese people have not embraced pristine nature as an ideal. The celebrated scenic spots of China, Huangshan Shan, Taishan, the surreal limestone towers of Guilin, and the Three Gorges themselves, all disclose religious architecture and are moreover soaked in legend, history, and art. Chinese landscape painting itself provides evidence of a lack of commitment to pristineness. Well known for showing nature in all its wildness and sublimity, yet it is never without some sign of human habitation and use. A hut here, a fishing boat there, or a traveler on a donkey moving up a mountain pass.
That's a passage from the book Coming Home to China by Yi Fu Tuan, our guest this hour on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. That's very interesting about a different concept of nature and of the wilderness and how that affects buildings and the use of space in general. Can you talk about your experience going back to China 64 years after you had left and journeying down the Yangtze River?
Journey down the Yangtze River, of course, the high point was passing the Three Gorges, which is such a reputation. But I knew, of course, that these huge dams had been built that had raised the level of the water by several hundred feet already. And so the gorges were probably not as impressive as I learned from literature. So I was ready for disappointment. But when we actually got there and the boat was passing through the gorges, I remained enormously impressed by the scale and grandeur of it, such a reminder of the best landscape paintings of towering peaks and waterfalls. We, customers of the boat or tourists, all, of course, came to the deck where there were two guides. One was lecturing, telling us about the gorges in English and the other in Chinese. And the information provided by the guides, and they seemed very knowledgeable, at first I found very interesting. So he might point out to an exposed cliff in the distance and said that that cliff, we can't go there, but rest assured that a famous, say, poet from the Tang Dynasty had inscribed a poem on this cliff. And then we go by another feature, and he would have a story to tell. As I listened to him telling the stories, at first my thought was how these stories actually enhanced the meaning, if not the beauty, of these gorges. But as the stories went on and on and on interminably, I had said I had enough. I want to go downstairs because I felt that with the multiplication of stories, he was ruining nature. Mm-hmm. He was ruining nature not by building roads over it, but by making so thoroughly human that every little cliff, every little rivulet tells a story, human story. It just ruins nature for me.
Well, in a way, I suppose it's because it's almost as if those places belong to somebody else by implication in the story, and you can't come to it on your own terms and kind of define it the way you want to. It always, these stories make it in terms of somebody else's experiences.
Yes, there is an element maybe even of snobbery here, so I'm not quite sure that it really works this way. And this is a general question, not just limited to Three Gorges. And that is the degree to which prior knowledge enhance or, to the contrary, spoil your perception. So there is a literature, for instance, on the Niagara Falls, how some people felt Niagara Falls were spoiled for them because they first see it through these cheap postcards. In the days even before good color production, yes. It was just tinted. So when they got there, they couldn't get rid of the postcards, and it's kind of spoiled for them. But others say that knowing some good literature on the Niagara Falls or pictures actually helped them. And so the same worked for me in the Three Gorges, China. That is, when I think of a Tang poem there, and when I think of the great landscape paintings that I've seen, this prior knowledge, even bits of history, because actually wars were fought in the Three Gorges. And so in my imagination, I could hear the rush of horses, stampedes and killing, and the sorrow of it all sort of fading into the mist now that I see it. So these stories and knowledge enhanced my perception, I think, of the Three Gorges. But not the stories that this guide keeps piling on. They're not very imaginative. It just goes on and on. And they're like, for me, like these cheap postcards that ruin
right.
my perception.
I have a question for you about the Chinese landscape painting that we often see on scrolls that has a misty, foggy quality to it. Can you say something about why that is and how that shapes how you see the landscape if you're looking at what to Western eyes can look blurred or ambiguous?
The mists, the whirling clouds, and the peaks and the water, all, of course, are richly symbolic, as Western scholars well know, are symbols that have a great deal to do with Taoism. So much so that Westerners begin to wonder whether there were actually such landscapes because of the heavy symbolism that they were told. The symbolism is definitely there, but so is the landscape. I mean, if you go to China, you can actually see things that are almost exactly like these landscape paintings with these waterfalls and whirling clouds. But there's almost surely a peculiar Chinese emphasis on clouds and mists. I mean, after all, you have clouds and mists in this country, but painters don't particularly stress that. And that's where the kind of mystical element in Taoism comes in, that these places were kind of haunted by hermits who are not totally human. You know, all this is enforced by what you call the lack of clarity, that the mist that surrounds it, it's almost dreamlike, not quite this world.
I'm not sure that you mention in your book visiting temples, but did you have a sense, if so, of a change of use of that space?
No, I didn't visit any temple, but I did go by, you know, that's quite true, because at one of the stops along the Yangtze River, we did go to one of these temples. And so they are being maintained and are becoming tourist centers. And I think perhaps for this reason, they are maintained and people are religious, I mean Chinese. And this is something that I don't like about the China that I found. And that is, I almost wish that the fanatics of the Cultural Revolution, the Red Guards, had been more thorough. And that is the Red Guards' Cultural Revolution, but the People's Republic generally had tried to get rid of what they saw as superstitions in the funeral rites. This is something I found fascinating. There is a part of China which is pretty much at the center of the country where three groups of Chinese meet. They are the Han Chinese, the Muslim Chinese. Islam and Muslim Arabs had moved to China sometime maybe in the 7th or 8th century, and not in small numbers. And so you can't say that they are foreigners. They're totally Chinese. They look Chinese, but there are certain words, practices that clearly is Muslim, Islamic. And they're Tibetans. And they all live together in this part of China. And their villages mix. So the Muslim village would be next to the Chinese one. There are periodic deep conflicts there. And the major conflict was over attitude toward the dead. What is interesting to me is that, in my view, the Chinese are perhaps, to my view, the least religious. And why do I say that? They're the least religious because they make the most fuss over the dead. You know, this is a contradictory view. This is not the generally accepted view. People think if you make a lot of fuss over the dead, then you must be religious. To me, it's just the opposite. And also opposite in the sense that the Chinese conception of what goes beyond death is almost the exact replica of this life. So the funeral involves the burning of paper money, paper carriages, and now paper automobiles, because the dead could then ride in them in a city that's a replica of this one. And to me, that's not a religious temperament. Religious temperament, you don't just continue what you have here and hope to hang on. Well, the Muslims are different. Their view I find perhaps most sympathetic because it's kind of closest to the West, namely the dead are buried in a park-like setting. So that's very nice. But the Chinese thought that this was not good because apparently the Muslim Chinese had no elaborate rituals in the burial, and the body is wrapped in a kind of a cloth and just put there and no great fuss. The fuss being, if that's the word, over the setting, which is lovely. And I thought that, you know, if I had the choice, this is the way I like it. So I consider the Muslim Chinese more religious than the Han Chinese. And then the Tibetans, they are the really religious people. And guess what? They just throw it into the valley for the body to be eaten by vultures.
Because the body, the material part, right, is the least important.
Right. I mean, they really believe that there is something totally other beyond just the body. This old Chinese-style funeral is returning. That's another aspect of culture you can't repress. It just comes back.
Our guest has been Yifu Tuan, talking about coming home to China and fascinating journeys in space and time. Thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4, during University of the Air, we'll go behind the scenes for a production of A Raisin in the Sun, the classic 1960 play by Lorraine Hansberry. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4, University of the Air, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.